It's 2:06 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. If you were really listening carefully to the very opening of our show, you would have heard that producer Lisa Clark, the music she picked was in honor of our subject today, healthcare. It was Steely Dan, Dr. Wu, who was not, by the way, an MD, to the best of my knowledge. But thank you for that music. Lisa, that was Dianne Feinstein and Speaker Paul Ryan, by the way, whose voices were in that opening of the show. We're going to talk healthcare today. Jim Galloway, my colleague on Monday and Friday edition of Political Rewind, is here. You know him as the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you back, Jim.
Great to be here.
Andy Miller from Georgia Health News is here. We always turn to you, Andy, when we are scratching our heads trying to figure out just what the heck is going on with healthcare legislation. And you said before the show started you have every single answer about this new bill.
Well, maybe not everyone, but glad to be here, Bill.
Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist who has worked for Republicans on Capitol Hill. Most recently, he was the communications director, deputy chief of staff for Governor Deal. Brian, it's always a pleasure to see you.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
And Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from up there in Cobb County, just back from Cobb County this afternoon. Big luncheon where the Cobb County Foundation was giving away some grant money?
That's right, and I'm a proud Medicare recipient.
Okay. Well, for the time being.
Yeah, we're working on that, buddy.
So just a couple of quick notes. As many of you know, Sally Yates is scheduled to testify in front of a Senate committee. In fact, it's scheduled to start at 2:30 this afternoon. She's going up before the Senate Judiciary Committee. You'll recall she became acting attorney general after Loretta Lynch stepped down. She was fired by Trump fairly quickly. But the reason she's up on Capitol Hill is because she has a story to tell about a warning she gave to some Trump White House insiders about Michael Flynn's involvement with the Russians, and we're going to learn more about exactly what that warning was. How much information did she have? What exactly did she tell the White House? It is an open hearing, so we'll get some information, although anything relating to the investigation of possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia won't come out because that would be held in closed sessions. Right, Jim?
Right, right. That's even so. She was only acting attorney general for 10 days.
Yes, exactly.
And my gosh.
She let go, not related to this story at all, but because she instructed her lawyers in the Justice Department not to defend the Trump travel ban in its first incarnation.
Right,
and Trump
right.
immediately fired her and tweeted that she was weak on borders, weak on security. She had to go.
And she'll get quizzed about that today.
Yeah, undoubtedly that will come up. So if anything happens, we'll be monitoring that once it gets started, although it probably won't start really. If it's you all know, Buddy Darden, if it's a 2:30 start time, they probably get going around 10 to 3.
Oh, 3:15.
Okay. Well, the business at hand for us, though, today is the Republican health care bill, which, as we all know by now, passed on Thursday after some aborted efforts earlier in the process. It's now over in the Senate. And Andy Miller and everybody else, of course, is going to weigh in on this. But I thought it was important because we've now had a weekend look at this a little bit more in detail, to process it a bit more. So let's talk about this bill, what you see it as doing, and if we can dispel some myths, if there are any there, but just help our listeners understand what's in the bill. What are the first most important things we should be looking at here, Andy?
Well, there's probably four or five that we need to know about. First of all, it's very similar to the original Republican bill. I mean, it keeps a lot of the things that were in that. For instance, individuals will no longer be required to get coverage or face a financial penalty. That's gone under this.
What's known as the individual mandate.
That's correct. People will still be able to get credits or subsidies for insurance, but they, under the GOP plan, they're going to be based on age and not under not income like there was under Obamacare. So that's different.
So what does that mean? How will it be based on age?
Well, young people will get a tax credit of about $2,000. Older people will get a tax credit of about $4,000. So it will depend really on where people are in the income level type of thing and the age type of thing as to how they'll be affected by the House plan. Now, one thing that does change is insurers under the GOP plan will be able to charge older people five times what they charge younger people. Under Obamacare, it was limited to three times. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a big change, and that will hit people in their kind of in the 50 to 64 age range. They will most of them will see premium increases as a result of that.
Okay, so could we hit the pause button for a moment? Because that's an important part of this. I mean, everything you're talking about is important, but this is a great moment to just begin discussing that in and of itself, okay? So, Brian, you would think that since it's older people who vote, that the last thing you'd want to do is what appears to be penalizing in some way people for getting older and forcing them to pay more, even though, I think I'm right, Andy, they do have a provision in the bill which offers subsidies to older people who need insurance, I think, yes?
Well, no, it's mainly the tax credit.
Okay.
I mean, these people, that's why AARP is strongly opposed to this, the GOP plan.
They don't get an increased tax credit when they're older?
Okay. Well, they do. They do get an increased tax credit,
okay.
But that's not going to cover that higher premium for a lot of people.
Then go to the political question. Is this what you want to do to people who turn out to vote in every election?
Well, the political question, I think, is the hardest one for Republicans to answer here, because it's very difficult and unprecedented in American history to rescind an entitlement. And we are on the precipice, perhaps, of doing that, even though there should be significant changes going through the Senate. And that's one thing we can't get too far ahead of ourselves. This bill is very far from complete.
Sure.
There's going to be a lot of sugar added to it. They had to go with a really conservative plan to bring in the House Freedom Caucus, which is significantly to the right, really, even of the mainstream of the party. So there's a lot of change to come. But look, to do the responsible thing in American government or in state government, to do what sustainable spending calls for, is never politically popular. But I think one thing I give them a lot of credit for is them acknowledging the reality that we are on an unsustainable course. We cannot continue to pay for these programs the way we have in the past. It is ballooning out of control and has been for a very long time. These programs will collapse under their own weight, just as the Obamacare exchanges are doing all over the country.
I don't think it makes any difference, really, what the House has done, because everybody knows that it was just a mechanism and a gimmick to get it through the right-wing Freedom Caucus. And while they've been now satisfied for the time being, the bill's going to start all over again. And the most important person in Washington today is Lamar Alexander. He is the chairman of the committee that is going to write a new bill. And while they over in the House think that they have gone down and celebrated and had a great day of gloating and so forth and so on, the president could care less, really, about what's in the bill and what the Freedom Caucus members want. He just wants a bill. He wants to be able to say he's done one. And so what I think you'll see coming out of the Senate won't even remotely resemble what the House has done, Brian.
Now, did I hear correctly that the Senate right now is on schedule not to produce a bill until after the midterms?
I haven't heard it. Andy, have you heard that? I think they're talking about later this year.
It's going to be a while. It's going to be a while. It's going to take them months, and that they want to do it more deliberately. And one of the reasons we're going to see big changes is what the original bill does to the Medicaid program. I mean, it takes $880 billion out of Medicaid. And if you think about it, there's 31 states that passed Medicaid expansion. So that means, what, 62 senators, right, that are in Medicaid expansion states. And those states, a lot of them want to keep the thing the way it is. They don't want to see those huge cuts into Medicaid.
Okay, so
I'll call on Brian, though, to tell you that Georgia is even in a worse mess. And tell us why, Brian.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been sounding the alarm on this. I mean, what the House version does is hurts states that haven't expanded, the states that took what nationally is seen as the Republican position. It keeps those states from ever capturing those dollars that were promised to them under Obamacare. But states that did expand, for a period of time at least, will continue to capture those dollars, meaning Georgia's federal tax dollars, our, everybody sitting at this table and everybody listening, your tax dollars go to Washington and then from there to California, New York, et cetera.
Okay. Andy, if you'll allow me, I need a GOP health care bill for dummies moment here. What, when you say this bill takes $880 billion out of Medicaid over, I think, a decade.
It's a decade.
What does that mean, takes it out? What do you mean, takes it out?
Well, not only is Medicaid expansion going to gradually go away in the states that expanded starting in 2019 or 2020. But it also converts the program into a block grant. And this is something that Paul Ryan has been seeking and a lot of conservative Republicans have been seeking, the fact that they will limit federal spending on Medicaid. In exchange, they'll give a lump sum to the states in order to decide how they're going to run the program, whether it's in terms of benefits or eligibility or whatever. And so that's going to really drive that number, that $880 billion, the fact that it's going to go to a block grant and it won't be an entitlement program as much anymore.
And it's based on what you've been receiving.
That's
so
correct.
So Georgia is in the position now of having foregone
expanding
$15 billion
yeah.
of money that would have come, anticipating that it would be straightened out, and now Georgia appears to be punished now because the block grants are going to be determined by what we've been getting.
By current spending.
Jim, right, and this is, and Governor Nathan Deal had expressed some worry about this during in the first iteration of this bill. Andy, let me ask you a question. Okay, one of the big objections among Republicans to the Affordable Care Act was the mandate that you had to sign up for insurance or you were going to pay a fine. What are the coercive elements of the Republican replacement? Because there are some.
Yeah. But they're much less onerous. In other words, if I go without coverage and I want to buy coverage at some time in the future, I'll be charged like a 30% premium, one 30% add-on premium.
If you let your coverage lapse for
yes.
1 year.
Or, well, it,
I
this
think.
Is
Isn't
like
that right?
It's like 63 days or something
that short?
Like that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not very long, but if you go uninsured and you want to get, you know, buy coverage, you'll have to pay a 30% add-on to your normal premium, but that's only for a year. Right now, it's interesting that the Trump administration has stopped enforcing the mandate now. The IRS is told, don't worry about the financial penalty, which I think has got a lot of insurers concerned.
Yeah. So, okay. What I'd love to do, let's take a moment here. Tom Price, our HHS secretary, who had a lot to do with this bill, was on Meet the Press yesterday morning. He faced some pretty tough questions on the show yesterday from Andrea Mitchell, who was filling in for Chuck Todd. And I just want to play, because it goes to the heart, I think, of the messaging around this bill. It's based on Trump saying, healthcare for everyone, it'll be the best ever. And essentially, that was the first thing he was asked. And we're going to listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
No, I think it's absolutely true that the president is fulfilling his promise to the American people, and that is to make certain that every single American has access to the kind of coverage that they want for themselves and for their family, not that the government forces them to buy, and make certain that we ensure that individuals with pre-existing illnesses and injuries and conditions are covered, but covered in a way that they want, again, not that Washington forces them. It's important to look at the people that we're talking about. If you have Medicare, if you have Medicaid, if you have insurance through the VA, or TRICARE or through your employer, none of this affects you in the pre-existing illness or condition discussion that we're having. If you do have a pre-existing condition and you're in the exchange market right now, remember that many, many people have increasing premiums, increasing deductibles. They're in an area in this country where there is either one insurer offering coverage or in some places none. Those are folks that have pre-existing illnesses and injuries and can't get any care at all. They may have an insurance card, but they can't get care.
All right, Andy, Price already was awarded four Pinocchios by the Washington Post for a lot of his messaging around this bill over the weekend. We should say that, fill us in. I mean, I know that that's a lot to take in there.
Right.
But what do you make of the way he described all this?
Well, a lot of the messaging by the supporters of the bill, they talk a lot about access. You know, everybody's going to have access to health insurance. But the key thing is whether it's going to be affordable. We all can have access to buying, like a Maserati, you know, but can we all afford it?
Yeah.
And that's one issue. So we have to make the distinction between access and affordability. Secondly, he's talking about the problems in the marketplace under Obamacare, and certainly there are problems, mostly having to do with insurers pulling out of various regions. But the Democrats will point out, and they have pointed out, the fact that those problems can be fixed without repealing the law.
So, Jim, Brian, Buddy, all of you weigh in this. The reality is that the whole question of, yes, you have access, that doesn't mean you could afford it, was also a reasonable charge leveled at Obamacare, that premiums were going up higher and higher, that coverage was not what it could be. So it isn't as if this is a new problem. The Obamacare folks face the same issue, yes?
Yeah, exaggerates the problem.
But the point is, this was a fix that needed to be made in any case.
Well, and we're deciding to fix it with a sledgehammer here. I mean, this is not. There's been a decision not to build on what has come before, but to tear it completely down and start anew.
Brian?
Well, tearing it down and starting new is sort of the Trump platform, you know, and that's what America's voted for. I think a lot of Democrats last year were saying, you know, why are all these white, blue-collar workers supporting Trump when many of them finally got access to health care through the exchanges? Well, I know some of those folks. They could not afford what was being offered to them. And so what they saw from their perspective was people who didn't work, people who were, you know, a few rungs down on the income level were getting perhaps Medicaid
expansion. Yeah, they got the subsidies.
They got the huge subsidies, mm-hmm. But for people who went to work every day, made a little bit more, they didn't. All they got was a higher price and a mandate that they get it. So the mandate's important to making all of this happen. We keep hearing all about the pre-existing conditions. 4 out of 5 Americans say they support covering pre-existing conditions. That's the wrong question to ask. Do you support mandating coverage for pre-existing conditions if it means that you're going to pay $1,000 a month as opposed to $350? You ask that question, and you're going to see a completely different outcome on that polling question, and that's what this is about.
Well, it depends on the question that's asked, Brian. Of course, you're doing what we call a push poll, and that you've made the amounts of money greatly exaggerated, whereas it might be a little bit more. Some people would be glad to pay a little bit more for the common good of everybody. But there are some people, I think, who, like my friend Secretary Price, have just drunk the Kool-Aid, and I think the facts really don't matter. You've probably heard the story of Congressman Raul Labrador up in Idaho when someone asked him, well, does this mean that I'm going to lose my life because I can't get health care? He says, nobody's going to die because they don't get health care in this country.
All
so
right.
That's a little bit of the problem we got here is in messaging.
All right, buddy. We're going to let you have the last word in this break before the break because we do have to get one in. It's already 2:25 on Monday afternoon. We'll be right back to talk more about this health care bill and where it's headed. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Take your spring cleaning to the next level by donating your car, truck, or van to GPB. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup, and send you the paperwork for your tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Buddy Darden is here, so is Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway, and our special guest, Andy Miller, Georgia Health News, who has all the answers on health care. By the way, you know we've added a phone line where you can call and leave us a message, your opinion on any of the issues we're talking about or anything that really matters to you in the political sphere. The number is 678-757-4472. Leave your name and where you're calling from, please. And keep your message short, because long messages are not going to get played. And with that in mind, on Friday we asked you to call in and let us know how you were feeling about either Obamacare, the new health care bill, and we got this interesting call from one of our truck driver friends out there who listens to the show on the road.
What I don't like about national health care is the mandate that you have it and the penalty, because I'm a working class truck driver and I don't have enough money for health insurance. I don't have it. You know, back in the early 2000s, it just came with work. You just got it from your job. You know, you didn't have to do anything where I work now. I can't afford it.
Andy, is he correct that more and more employers are not offering health care? I mean, under the Obamacare bill, they have mandates on size of businesses that have to. But is he right that it's something that people are getting away from?
It is. It's been a long time trend before Obamacare and during Obamacare that employers have offered, fewer employers have offered coverage. In other words, fewer Americans get their health benefits through their employer. That's absolutely true. It's one reason why some companies are going hiring more part-time workers rather than, you know, they hire three part-time workers rather than one full-time worker. Healthcare is expensive.
Jim, it strikes me that the two issues that really have commanded the most attention in the aftermath of the passage of the bill are pre-existing conditions, and we should get into that a little bit more. The other one is essential health care benefits. You think I've identified the ones that are causing the most concern out there?
I think you've identified the most politically volatile out there.
Right.
Especially the latter, the existential questions of what has to be covered. Because, of course, you've got a great male-female divide in that area, and that can be translated, as we've seen, to many, many political contests.
All right. So, Andy, one of the ways that the Republicans were able to get the votes they needed to pass this bill, they had to bring in the most conservative members of the House, the Republican conference in the House. And they did it with this notion of waivers that states could apply for. And it specifically applies to pre-existing conditions and I think essential health care benefits as well. What does that mean, waivers?
Well, a state can propose to the federal government a different set of rules under a waiver and get that approval and from the feds. And so what the two waivers that you're talking about is, one, states could say, look, we don't want to require all insurers to cover all 10 essential benefits. We want to let them kind of pare down the benefits in order to make premiums go down. And so insurers, if a state got a waiver and they said, look, we're going to allow insurers to do this, an insurer could offer plans that, like, say, don't have maternity coverage, don't have prescription drug coverage, don't have substance abuse treatment coverage.
Or emergency room coverage.
Or emergency room or even outpatient coverage. And so some of the fear going along with that is, let's say, that most insurers will say, well, we're not going to cover maternity. And then there might be a couple of plans that say we want to cover maternity, but those premiums would go really a lot higher than the ones that would be attractive to a male who's like in single and 58 and not going to have the pregnancy coverage need.
Okay, to go back again to my need for GOP healthcare bill for dummies, if waivers are required, mm-hmm. does that mean that the basic bill itself does include protection for pre-existing conditions and does have essential health care benefits? If not, why would you need a waiver? The language must include those things for the whole country.
Well, states would have the premium or the privilege and the ability to go ahead
to opt out
right. of the essential health benefits and opt out of the pre-existing condition ban. So getting the pre-existing condition ban, a state could say to insurers, if they get this waiver, they could say to insurers, look, you can charge people with health conditions more.
Yeah.
But the state would also have to set up a high-risk pool.
right,
in order to capture some of these people that wouldn't be offered coverage.
All right, let's talk politics around this.
Well, I want to ask Andy a question that really matters, and that is, let's assume that the state of Georgia decided that the cost of its own health policy for its employees and its teachers may be covered too much, and perhaps there ought to be more co-pays, there ought to be more participation by the individuals, the insureds. Could they pretty much do whatever they wanted to do under the GOP bill?
They, as long as the state had permission to go ahead and cut down on these essential benefits, and as long as the state got a waiver to charge people with pre-existing conditions more. So the state would actively have to say, look, we want more control over health insurance, so we want these waivers. That's what would happen.
Brian, let me ask both you and Andy a question here. Now we know that the House bill is pretty much dead on arrival in the Senate. They're going to and they're going to start all over again. But are there certain features that are likely to remain? And I'm thinking specifically of the block grants on Medicaid. Is that likely to be something that carries through the whole of this process?
I think it sort of runs into some of the same problems that Andy alluded to earlier. You have certain states that are going to be penalized by that. But a lot of Republicans have talked about block grants for many years. I know we have here in Georgia something Governor Deal has talked a lot about, and it's even something that the Georgia Healthcare Access Task Force that I was involved with and did some work with Andy on talked a lot about. Now, Georgia wants the flexibility of how to spend our Medicaid dollars. It allows us to decide what income levels should be our cutoff, what benefits we should provide. I think in Georgia, traditionally and probably moving forward, there's going to be a lot of resistance amongst Republican leaders to providing Medicaid to able-bodied, working-age adults without children. But getting that block grant will allow us to service our most needy citizens and do it in a way that meets with our principles and our values here.
But, Brian, will we not be getting the same block grant that states similarly situated to us who elected to go with Medicaid expansion? In other words, won't Georgia be penalized unless our senators do something about the formula, which is already passed the House and now will be coming back from the Senate? So what I'm saying is the formula that right now has been passed by the House should be unacceptable to our Georgia senators.
Well, I will defer to Andy if he wants to correct me. But my understanding of it is that Georgia would be penalized relative to other states nationally because we have a fairly low-paying Medicaid system.
We're one of the lowest.
One of the lowest. I think maybe Texas is
or Nevada or something like that. So lower. So basically, we would be the House bill bases how much money Georgia would get per enrollee, per beneficiary, on the 2016 spending level. And Georgia is one of the lowest per beneficiary spending states in terms of Medicaid. So, we would start off with a lot lower baseline in terms of funding from the feds.
So I'm going to make a prediction then. And of course, Brian, you got in trouble last time you made a big prediction, but that Trump wouldn't get the nomination. But I'm going to predict that a bill will come out of the Senate in such a form that it will be unacceptable to the Freedom Caucus, but will attract enough Democratic votes that the conference report will pass.
Well, buddy, I am so glad you said that, because I had just said to Trevor Morris, hey, let's listen to that Susan Collins, Senator Susan Collins soundbite, because she yesterday talked about in the Senate about doing just what you're suggesting. And Johnny Isaacson's a part of what she had to say.
I would like to see us put together a bipartisan group to solve this problem of Democrats who acknowledge that there are problems with the current law, that it is not working well in several states, and Republicans who also want to make sure that we're not reducing coverage and we're giving flexibility.
So that's Senator Susan Collins. And Andy, we are going to see a brand new version of this bill almost certainly.
She says we're going to start from scratch. It's basically what Bernie Sanders is saying as well. I think it will be substantially different.
So, Brian, you want to weigh in on that?
Here's the problem with that. And, you know, I'm one of those Republicans and Buddy is one of those Democrats who believe that most of the common sense solutions for this country are going to be found somewhere in the middle in a bipartisan way. Because when you start talking about the extremes of either party, you are talking about something that benefits one group and another group really hurts. On both sides, that's how it is. And that centrist is one that tries to ameliorate those differences and come out to the one where they're the most winners possible and the fewest losers possible, where some people give a little bit and others get a little bit. Here's the thing. A bipartisan solution will not work because it cannot pass in the House. And it cannot pass in the House because the Democrats under Nancy Pelosi, and I'm not even attacking them for this because we would do the same thing, but the Democrats under Nancy Pelosi are not going to give President Trump a victory. Look at what Chuck Schumer did in the Senate. He was willing to fall on the sword and blow up his ability to stop future judicial picks that he found wildly inappropriate because he could not stand it to his donors and allow Gorsuch to go forward. They are captured to their big dollar donors on the far right and the far left. And that's the problem here. The Democrats will not and cannot allow Trump a victory. That's why you might see a much more conservative plan than what the Senate would really like to pass.
All right. Let's stop with the politics just for a sec. I mean, I'm hearing what you're saying there, and it will be interesting to watch how that develops. But, Andy, let's go back. I want to go to pre-existing conditions again quickly. It is my understanding that we don't really know what is defined as a pre-existing condition. I think I've already heard it here that different states might define that differently if this kind of bill goes through and ask for waivers. Some states might include maternity. Others may not include maternity care as an essential benefit. So there's incredible latitude here for individual states to go their own way. Is that what we're saying?
It will be. And if a state pursues a waiver and gets it, they'll just have to, they can set up their high-risk pool. But remember something, Bill, about high-risk pools. Like they were out there before the ACA. They were in a couple of states, they worked pretty well. But in most states, they weren't well-funded. Yeah. And the premiums for the members were really high and the deductibles were really high. And a lot of these high-risk pools limited the participation. And so there's now in the new bill something like, you know, $138 billion that could be spent for these high-risk pools and related things. And but there, most of the analysis of that says, look, that's not enough. These people are very expensive to cover. And if many states do the high-risk pool and do the waivers, it won't cover all the people that need it.
Andy, before we went on the air, you were talking about the old days.
Yes.
When a person was locked in a job that he or she did not like but couldn't leave because the insurance was non-transferable. Are we headed back there?
Well, let's set that up because, Andy, one of the things that matters, Jim, I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to go there too. This bill, although it deals with the exchanges and people who aren't covered by other forms of insurance, as Tom Price discussed, There is language in the bill that has some controlling influence on the insurance that many people get through their workplace. And
right.
That's what Jim's talking about here.
Exactly. Before the ACA, you had a lot of people who were in jobs that, you know, corporate jobs, they had employer-based insurance, but they may have a pre-existing condition or somebody in their family. And if they wanted to start their own business, let's say they were in their 50s and wanted to go out, they were kind of prevented by the insurance rules to go out there and do that because they would be afraid that they or their family would not have coverage under the old rules, where an insurance company could deny coverage or make it so totally unaffordable. So now it could be that people will go, and Obamacare got rid of job lock because it got rid of pre-existing conditions. But if we go back to that in a state that does one of these waivers, people could get job locked again and be afraid that they wouldn't get coverage if they went and left their job in order to create their own business.
So let me ask this from the other point of view. Brian, let me come to you on this. Let's say that the final bill, once the Senate passes their version, comes to conference, let's say it does become law. If there is, in fact, some provision for states to have waivers on pre-existing conditions or, for that matter, essential health care benefits. Now, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, already this weekend, he said, made a statement and then withdrew it very quickly that, yeah, I could see getting rid of some of these essential benefits. So we've already had one governor weigh in on this. But, Brian, if all politics is local and your former boss, Governor Deal, is in a position where he can define essential benefits and get a waiver to cover or not cover them, from a political point of view, I mean, the politics are going to have a big impact. He's not going to deny women maternity care. He's not likely to deny emergency. I mean, what I'm saying is it strikes me that this is throwing this all back into a political ball game that might make it even scarier as to how it all unfolds. Am I being unrealistic?
No, because we've seen this battle play out locally, even under current law. You know, as Jim can attest, in recent sessions, we've seen over and over again this battle over covering autism, and because it's getting to be a bigger and bigger issue, and more children are being born with it. And we have learned that early intervention and treatment can make a remarkable difference in a child's development and being able to sort of grow out of the tendencies of that condition. So it's very difficult, and we've always moved toward covering more, not toward covering less. It's very hard. But again, the question comes down to who pays for what? Who pays and who gets? That's what it is. If we want to cover all these things, great. Look, we're all going to pay more in our premiums. And in fact, we're going to pay significantly more. I disagree with Buddy. That's just a small difference. If we're going to do all of this stuff, we're all going to pay a lot. That's what Obamacare is all about. We all pay more than we should for the healthy and young, so that the old and the sick can get more.
But I would disagree with you, Brian. I don't think we've in the last say 10 years the state capitol has gotten more and more reluctant to broaden mandated insurance coverage
because it's expensive.
And I will tell you where it has really broken down. 15 years ago in the state capitol, you used to be able to count on the fact that Republican women and Democratic women would team up together, and they created a powerful block of votes there to mandate care for breast cancer screenings, et cetera. And
the ability to stay in the hospital for 2 days after you have a baby.
Right, all that. Now, and in the last 10 years, You've seen that alliance break down along party lines.
So these are the kinds of arguments we could anticipate would happen in states around the country when it comes to looking for the kind of waiver a state might apply for, right, Andy?
That's correct. And the argument would be that for insurers, I mean, the people who are in favor of waivers would say, look, we can lower premiums this way if we shrink down the essential health benefits and if we move the pre-existing people into a high-risk pool.
We've got to take another break, but let me ask you this question because I've heard no one answer this, and maybe I just didn't hear it. I don't mean here. I mean out there in the news world. We all know that there was no CBO score before the House voted on this. Is there going to be a CBO score? Are they working on one, to the best of our knowledge, right now that the Senate will be able to work from? Does it have to be requested before the CBO goes into effect? I don't know how that works. Does anybody?
As I understood it, the CBO score they're currently working
they
on
are.
It, and it might be available late today, maybe early
okay.
tomorrow.
Okay, good. See, that's why you're here, Galloway, because you have all those answers. It's 2:44. We've got to get in our final break of the show, but we're going to come right back. We got a few other things we want to talk about, and we'll do that when we return.
On the next Fresh Air, Gabourey Sidibe. She made her acting debut in Lee Daniels' 2009 film Precious, a role that got her an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. Since then, she's been in Empire, The Big C, and American Horror Story. Sidibe has a new memoir called This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Late breaking news from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Sally Yates is sitting at the witness table, and according to Lisa Clark, Lindsey Graham has been making his opening remarks. So within the next 15 minutes or so, maybe we'll hear what Sally Yates. The Atlanta attorney who is up there right now answering questions about what she knew about Mike Flynn and his involvement with the Russians. Jim Galloway, while we have Andy here, Governor Deal signed an important bill relating to rural health care today.
Yeah, this was SB 180. I believe it raises the percentage that a corporation can take as
or
a tax
individual.
Credit or an individual can take as a tax credit for donations made to a rural hospital.
Right. This Georgia is the only state, as I understand, the only state that has this program, and it was developed last year by Jeff Duncan, a coming Republican. It was at 70%. So if you donated as an individual or a company, you got a 70% tax break. Now it's 90% tax credit. And the thought is that it will help some of these struggling rural hospitals in our state. I mean, we've had 7 rural hospitals close since the beginning of 2013, and others are struggling financially to keep the doors open.
And the hope is that some of these donations are coming from the corporations that do business in that area and desperately need
their hospital. Like a Walmart or a Dollar General or something like that that are in many of these rural communities.
In fact, in Louisville, Georgia, down in Jefferson County, the voters actually approved a referendum recently to keep their hospital open, and hopefully this might help here. But again, it's a tremendous struggle for these small hospitals in this climate. And as the president said, and here's something I agree with the president on, this is a very complicated subject, this health care. And I don't think he or anybody realizes quite once you get into it what you're doing, which brings me back to my political point a while ago. And here's where I have a healthy disagreement with Brian, in that I believe that the president wants a health care bill so badly that he'll be willing to make an enormous number of concessions to the Democrats, just like he wanted to keep the government open, and that in the end he'll be willing to ignore the Freedom Caucus if it means passing a bill.
He certainly doesn't mind taking them on. And I could tell you one thing on these rural hospitals, this is an ongoing problem, and it reflects the fact that our population has moved out of those areas. We used to have a farm economy here. It's still our number one industry, but it's much more efficient now, much more industrialized. People have moved to the cities. So these hospitals are serving a smaller and smaller population and a poorer and poorer population, and the economics just don't work. And one thing the Georgia Hospital Association has been saying is that on the current trajectory, the 7 hospital closings that Andy mentioned are just the tip of the iceberg. The next 2 years will be devastating without significant changes in the ability to ensure those people in rural Georgia so that when they show up at these hospital doors, they are paying customers.
Well, Andy, presumably that's one of the reasons why there was talk before Donald Trump was elected that this was going to be the session, the one we just ended, where Georgia finally addressed the notion of expanding Medicaid, right?
I think there was real momentum, including among some key Republican state senators, to consider something like this, because, you know, if you're a rural hospital and you're serving more and more uninsured, think about it. If you get an uninsured patient, you might get zero in terms of payment from them. But if that person is covered by Medicaid suddenly, the hospital will get some payment for that service that they delivered.
All right. We've had some tweets come in to Politics GPB. Let me read you just a couple of them. Chad Braswell writes, premiums were on the rise before the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare industry used it as an excuse for raising rates. Is that right?
Healthcare premiums have almost always gone up.
No matter what.
Yeah. Look at the cost of prescription drugs going up. I mean, that's one reason right there.
But I will go along with this. I know of several instances in which small law firms were told their premiums were going to go up. They said they could do okay on Obamacare, and all of a sudden, it turns out that their insurance agent was able to meet the price of Obamacare. So I am saying that, yes, I think he's right. There has been a pretext of saying that Obamacare is going to necessarily make your premiums go way up.
Shell Newman channels Bernie Sanders by asking, in regards to the new Health Care Act, why is it not feasible to have a health care system like Sweden's?
Or Australia's.
Australia. We're all laughing in case you missed it. Tell them why we're laughing, Jim.
Well, because on Thursday, the same day the House Republicans passed the repeal bill, you had Donald Trump saying we need he was meeting with the Australian Prime Minister. And you know, he was saying, gosh, Australia has such a great healthcare system. It's better than ours. We need something just like it, which is terrific messaging if you're a Republican.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders seized on that immediately, as I remember.
There is, Andy, simply no appetite, in terms of the majority, for a single-payer system in the United States.
Well, we're the only Western industrialized country that doesn't cover all our citizens with some form of insurance. And so there is some thought that if this bill, GOP bill passes, and it does, and it, you know, a lot of people lose coverage, it may lead more political kind of drive to take a look at something like single payer. I'm not saying it's going to happen right away.
All right, I'm back to my need to be helped along. What does, very quickly though, what does it mean to have a single payer health care system?
Well, everybody being covered under Medicare, for example.
It'd be like so, like Medicare. Everybody's under Medicare.
Right. Yeah. So the government runs a big insurance system that we all buy into and get covered.
Right. And, you know, Medicare does have private insurance within it. So you can buy a traditional government plan under Medicare, or you can go with an insurance company version of it as well.
All right. Roy Everett says, what happens to the cost when young, healthy people fail to buy insurance? That, of course, was the flaw. That was what the Obama bill wanted to address, was you needed to have healthy people in the system to support the sicker people, older people, and that is why there was a mandate. Barring a mandate, what does happen if young people don't buy into the system? Andy, you want to start with that?
Well, they wouldn't have the incentive or the stick, the financial stick, to buy coverage. I mean, one criticism of Obamacare by some people is that the tax penalty wasn't high enough. It wasn't strong enough to get a lot of these young people in it.
Yeah.
I taught last fall at the University of Georgia, and it was a really eye-opening experience because I don't know many millennials in my day-to-day life. They're not my neighbors. I don't have kids that age. They're coming out of college with more college debt than any generation that has come before them. They are coming into a jobs economy where the entry-level work pays very little and really has since the Great Recession. We haven't fully rebounded from that. They are one of the first generations of Americans who have very little hope of being able to scrounge up a down payment for a home in their 20s. Many, more so than any generation before, are going home to live with their parents because they can't afford it. What Obamacare does is say, okay, guys, as soon as you get that first job, you're going to be paying for the people who 12% of your paycheck is already going to, because it's going to go to Medicare and Social Security. It's going to go from the poorest generation of Americans to the per capita wealthiest generation of Americans. And that's what Obamacare is. Look, it stinks that old people had to pay more. It stinks that the sick get stranded on the island. It's terrible. But let's not pretend that there are easy answers. The people who are going to be asked to foot the bill face huge challenges of their own in today's American society.
Okay, Brian, you're forgetting one thing, is those students that over the University of Georgia already under mandatory health care, and they are paying a health services fee, and they think that, of course, they are, bulletproof, because they're already covered, and once they get out, it'll continue to be that way. But I was young one time, and I thought I had that same attitude, but sometimes you got to realize that you've got to step back and look at the greater good for society, and I think this is one of those issues.
One of the most popular provisions of Obamacare is you can stay on your parents' insurance until age 26.
Right.
So a lot of your millennials have done that, and that's going to be kept under the Republican bill.
We got a couple more tweets. Todd Ream, our good friend who we miss around here, tweets, Monroe County, we were talking about rural hospitals, passed a non-binding referendum to raise property taxes and support the hospital. It's non-binding. Nevertheless, it expresses the will of the voters, obviously. And then he says, Washington County passed a tax hike referendum to fund rural hospitals in 2016. And then we got a tweet from Samuel Bell, who says, quote, Bill Nygut says, quote, there is no appetite for single-payer health care in the U.S., utterly and typically tone deaf. Thank you, Samuel.
You never could carry a tune, could you?
I think that if you tried to introduce single payer on Capitol Hill, whether it's this administration or the Obama administration, the chances of it passing are relatively slim.
Slim to none. Right now.
Okay.
It'll happen in my lifetime. I think, the conservative element in this country today is white Republicans, and that is a smaller and smaller percentage of the population with each passing minute. And by the 2040s, 2050s, this will be a majority-minority country. And so I think there'll be less of these divisions along racial lines and make perhaps go back more toward a class-based political system.
All right, we got it real quick. Jim, we mentioned it in the opening, and I don't have a whole lot of time for it now, but we are on track. It now appears that the Karen Handel race against John Ossoff, most money ever spent on a congressional race. How much?
The record is 29.6 for a million for a Florida race, and we think we busted that.
$30 million plus dollars. And the race is still a month plus off.
And now, right now, today, as of today, we are in official challenge your opponent to a debate phase.
Okay, we're looking.
But remember, a week from tomorrow is the runoff for the state senate vacancy that was created.
State seat 32, district 32,
and Judson Hill's seat out of Marietta. It's a mostly an East Cobb seat.
And Jim has pointed out that that could be a bellwether for what might happen in the sixth district race.
A bellwether for the bellwether.
Yeah. All right. We are completely out of time. Excuse me. We're completely out of time for today's show. Thank you to Buddy Darden, to Brian Robinson. Andy Miller, it's so great to have you come in here and help us with healthcare. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Galloway, it's always wonderful to have you sitting over there.
One more, and then I'm on vacation.
And then you're on. I wasn't going to tell anybody that. If you want to leave a phone message telling us how you're feeling about politics today, about anything we said on the show, issues that matter to you right now, remember, we have a recorded line. It's 678-757-4472. Leave us your name. Leave us where you're calling from, your community, your county, your city. And keep your message relatively brief so that poor Jenny Ament doesn't have to spend half an hour editing down to the nub of what you had to say. We'll be back on Wednesday. Patricia Murphy is going to be here. Jackie Gingrich Cushman and Greg Bluestein will all be here. Who knows what we'll talk about? Probably Sally Yates' testimony, among many other things. Remember, if you can't hear us when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast or go to Political Insider at AJC.com. Jim Galloway will have this show posted, who knows, momentarily.
Oh, give me a half hour.
All right. That's it for us for today. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back here Wednesday at 2. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a great evening.